Welcome to the program. 2 weeks ago, we marked the events of 9/11, but what were we really marking? What did we celebrate? More than the physical landscape of Ground Zero and the 2,755 who perished, it's important that we also remember those that gave the last full measure of their devotion in the efforts to rescue those inside the building. The first responders and those engaged in the cleanup often mark that day as the beginning of the physical and emotional problems that scar them to this day. Today we're going to talk about their story. Their names are not noted or etched in the granite of Ground Zero, but our guest today, Dr. Benjamin Luft, found a way for their names to be equally enduring. Dr. Benjamin Luft is the Edmund D. Pellegrino Professor of Medicine at the State University of New York and established the Long Island World Trade Center Medical Monitoring Treatment Program, which provides care to more than 6,000 disaster responders and has become an incubator for several important research and treatment programs that emphasize both the mental and the physical well-being of these first responders. In addition, he's been engaged in putting together an oral history project of these men. He has compiled this work in a new book entitled We're Not Leaving, 9/11 Responders Tell Their Stories of Courage, Sacrifice, and Renewal. Dr. Benjamin Luft, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
It's great to have you here. First of all, tell us a little bit about how the treatment center, the Long Island World Trade Center Monitoring Treatment Program, came to be.
Well, immediately after 9/11, we at Stony Brook were waiting for those who responded to bring in the survivors of 9/11. Those who and we expected mass casualties, but during that eerie day, what we found was that there was this terrible silence. There were no ambulances that came. And it soon became evident that those people either survived the attack or they were killed. About a week later, I went down to Ground Zero, and I witnessed the site, and it was clearly evident that there was going to be a tremendous amount of toxic reaction in those who were responding. And so we established a free clinic at the university for those who weren't able to, who didn't have insurance or not able to pay, and that was the beginning of our responders program.
One of the things that you found as this process moved along is how complex it was dealing with the exposure to so many of these materials that these first responders had in fact been exposed to.
Absolutely. I think everybody can imagine the amount of physical exposure. I mean, there were two tremendous skyscrapers that were pulverized with a tremendous amount of dust, and there was burning of jet fuel and burning of plastics and computers and all of those things that we aren't even able to put into landfills nowadays. But the other part of it that was so complex is the psychic exposure, that this was a tremendously amount of psychiatric trauma. Just imagine when a responder would go in, they were faced with unfathomable amount of tragedy. There was not only was there carnage of bodies strewn about, but those bodies were dismembered in pieces. People were jumping. They were in constant danger. And this didn't go on just for a short period of time. This went on for a very prolonged period of time, lasting from days to months.
One of the things that you began to put together as part of this monitoring and treatment program is this collaborative model that took into account both the mental and the physical scarring and really found new things to deal with in terms of the nexus between the two.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. So it became evident to us that we had a very complex set of toxic reactions, both psychic and physical. And we also had a very special population that we were dealing with. The patients that we were dealing with had a tremendous amount of machismo. They were the firemen, the policemen. They were construction workers. They didn't want to hear about psychiatric issues. And so what we did initially was we took our internists and we trained them in some psychiatric medicine as well. And we said, and we took our social workers and we also had them expert in psychological counseling. And so when the patient came in, no matter who the patient was, they were treated in the exact same way, both for their medical and psychic injuries. And this worked remarkably well because as the patients acclimated to them, they they gained a tremendous amount of insight into both of the realms.
One of the things that you discovered in this as patients came into you is that the problems were even more serious than just the lung diseases and the lung problems that you might have expected, but extended to GI problems and lots of other physical areas.
Well, I think the thing is that, you know, sometimes we try to think of everything in a very reductionist way. You know, we think that you have either a lung problem or you have a GI problem. But actually, when the body is exposed to this type of injury, the whole body is affected. And so the manifestations of the disease affects all different types of organ systems concomitantly. And then when you put on top of it the psychic injury, the mind and the body are not separate from one another. They're integrally related to one another, and one impacts the other. And there's a cycle of injury that occurs as a result of that.
Come back to this point that you made before about the initial resistance on the part of many of these first responders to treatment in general, certainly to mental health treatment, but even in some cases downplaying the physical consequences.
Yes. Well, you know, these are people who are, you know, when you think about the responders, and it's part of our oral history project in the book that we wrote, We're Not Leaving, is that these responders are givers. They're not used to being sick. They're not used to receiving care. They're used to giving care. And so they tend to compartmentalize all of their problems. They put it aside. They put their pain aside. It sits in part of their a different part of their head, and they take care of the task at hand. It allows them to do what they do. It allows them to be the way that they are, which are, you know, responders. And so it was a great, in a lot of ways, for them to deal with the fact that they were now in need of services was not only a physical and, you know, mental health type of thing. It dealt with their very essence. You know, it dealt with a change in the way that they were relating to the world. They were going from this position of service to a position of need. And that was a great transition for some of them.
And how did that impact on their physical health? I mean, we talk a lot today, of course, and part of the collaborative model is about this mind-body connection. Talk about the impact of those attitudes in your ability as a doctor to deal with and treat the physical side of it.
Well, some of the things that occurred was that there was a tremendous amount of denial. So that people would come in, you would be able to have evidence by laboratory, other physiologic tests of abnormalities, but the patients would be denying that there was anything wrong with them, only allowing it to progress to a point that they were now sicker and sicker and coming in years after the first manifestation of the disease. The other aspect of it is that, as I said before, the mind and the body are not separate from one another. And what we find now is that those people who have this kind of psychic injury, whether it's a PTSD or anxiety disorder, that it acts almost as a mediator. It potentiates the physical problems. So that if you're not able to take care of both of these areas concomitantly, you're not able to break that cycle. And you're not able to go toward cure and well-being.
To what extent was there also a certain kind of survivor's guilt associated with many of these guys?
Oh, I think that's something that is so remarkable and to me personally so humbling. The responders, by and large, have a tremendous sense of humility. Many of them don't even reflect upon their tremendous sacrifice and courage and what they did. Instead, they wonder why they couldn't have done more. Why were they allowed to survive when their colleagues and fellow citizens succumbed to this attack? They can't fathom the reason for that. Certainly, it isn't easily understandable why one would die and one would live. But they have all merited a tremendous amount of respect for the way that they carried on.
One of the things that you discovered in treating these first responders as part of the World Trade Center Monitoring and Treatment Program is that these guys had powerful stories to tell. Talk a little bit about your realization about that and what you decided to do about it.
Well, you know, when we began to do our work, we began to do our work in a way was to take care of the medical and psychic needs of the responders. And there was a tremendous amount of interest in our general society as to what had happened to these people and their injuries and their diseases. And there was a certain amount of partisan politics that were going on at who was responsible for this and who should pay for it, et cetera. But what became evident to me was that these people were far greater than their diseases, and that they were being reduced to their diseases. The way that we were seeing them as individuals, was in terms of their disease, and instead I began to see them, or I had always seen them, in terms of who they were, in terms of the their motivation, their courage, their camaraderie, their strength, their collegiality, their tolerance. And then I thought of their sacrifice, not only in terms of their physical sacrifice, but the very existential sacrifice, as you mentioned, you know, this survivor's guilt, this humbleness, this humility, as well as their physical and psychological problems. And then finally, who these people were and how they were able to renew themselves. Where did they get their strength? And I thought that this was a much more universal and generalizable story that we could all get something out of. And so we began to do this oral history project, not so much to kind of emphasize, you know, the diseases that these people had, but really to emphasize their strength and who these people are. Who are these responders? Who are these heroes, and what we can learn from them?
One of the things that became clear as you began this effort is that this was really the first time that many of them had really had an opportunity to tell their story.
That's right. That was so surprising, because their stories are full of, you know, virtues and are so positive and something that really should be celebrated. And you would think that they would be talking to their families, perhaps to get a little bit of that glory, but that wasn't the case. The case was is that these were stories that they kept in their heart. They didn't want to burden anybody with these stories. They didn't want to rethink these episodes, and so they kept it to themselves, only to talk to us during these interviews. And as a result of that, when we did these videos, they're tremendously emotional laden, because it was this outpouring of exactly what happened, of what they lived through, of that marching into hell and then being able to march out of it, you know, with a tremendous amount of courage, a tremendous amount of sense of community and pride. And it just was, for me, it was a wonderful and uplifting experience.
What did you see in these men as they became unburdened, almost, of these stories? Could you see any kind of a change take place as they were able to tell these stories for the first time?
I think that for a lot of them, they became relieved. It was almost like that they were carrying these stories, and it had been interpreted for them by everyone around them except for themselves. And it was almost like the old story of the scapegoat, that, you know, you tell the story or you let people know, and you're almost, now it's in the world, it now exists, and you're no longer burden to carry it with you as being the only sense, you know, the only repository for it. And so I think that they were very, they were happy. And when I've seen them subsequently at subsequent visits, they're all very grateful. They're very thankful that they were given this opportunity. It's an opportunity for all of us. I am so glad that they feel that way. But certainly anyone that has seen these histories or have read them in the book or seen it in the films, that they also have a tremendous sense of really celebration of the spirit. This is the American spirit. I just think it's wonderful for what they did.
Talk about that spirit. And you, as somebody that has seen most of these and read most of these, The common themes, the common ideas that run through all of this.
Well, I think that there are certain things that are very American, I think. People don't realize, besides the first responders, who I call the professional responders, there was an equal number of non-professional responders, of volunteers, of people who were Joe citizens who just came down and did their part. And they spanned the entire spectrum from the illegal immigrant who would possibly be considered non-citizen to the celebrity who was, and each of them worked together on the pile, each of them sitting on these big bucket brigades, passing item to item, working hand in hand, looking together. So I think one of the great is this sense of volunteerism, this sense of community, of collegiality, of how well they got along together. The other sense that you see is this tremendous amount of courage, tinged with a tremendous amount of humility. None of them want to be recognized for their courage. You hear all again and again people telling stories of doing tremendously heroic activities, and then when they're basically identified for this, just totally shunning, whether it the commanders or the what they call the bosses, they just didn't want to be recognized for it. It was this tremendous feeling that they didn't deserve any special recognition, that this was part of their job. I think that those are those acts of courage, that act of community, and then the last part was where they sought their resilience. Where did they get their sense to keep going on? And that was really from their fellow Americans. They always look back as one of the greatest moments is when they were able to go out into the community and just get this sense from the American people that they were doing their job and that they were appreciated. And that's really, and you hear that over and over again. And then lastly, I think religion comes back. You see that again and again, of this renewal of the spirit, renewal of the faith. That's something, extremely moving for me. And I'm not a religious person in any way. But you can see that this greater desire for trying to find meaning, certainly when you're faced with such atrocity.
Did they see themselves as heroes?
By and large, I have not heard one who has characterized themselves as a hero. And they shun, when we ask that question very specifically, and almost to a person, they shun that designation. They see themselves as Americans. They see themselves as proud citizens. They see themselves as doing their job. And they say this is what any American would do. It is, as I said, it is extraordinarily humbling.
How did you overcome the resistance initially to get them to tell their stories?
Well, we didn't have as much resistance as one might expect. Part of it has to do with is the fact that I'm a physician, and that we've been treating I've been working on this project for 10 years. I know a lot of these people. They know, certainly almost all of them know who I am. I think that there is a natural relationship, and we went to great pain toward giving each and every one of these people that we did interview a very informed consent, much more than what one would consider in a normal, reportage type of interview. We went through a very formal process because I knew of my relationship to them. I knew the relationship of the clinic. I did not want to misinform them in any way. So it worked very well for us. No one refused to do an interview. No one, and as I said, I think of many of them, this was their opportunity to tell their story, to be debriefed. And they seized it, and they and they told it with great conviction and with great emotion.
Has there been a desire on the part of many of them to see the interviews of others, to watch others, to read others, to get a broader sense of what others had gone through?
For some, I think some of them talk to one another, not very often, but it is interesting. We do get we get correspondence from family members who would like to see the interviews of their of their fathers or mothers or sisters or brothers, which we tell them to come in, or if we can, we send them a small, they're far away, we send them a small vignette of that interview, which I find to be very interesting. This is their opportunity to hear what happened to mom, what happened to dad, to sis, to their brother. So that's another side of the whole equation.
Talk about the overall project. Many of these interviews are part of We're Not Leaving, the book that you've put together. So are they going to be available online for people to see? What is the planned scope of all of this?
Well, we have a website which has about eight vignettes. It's called 911respondersremember.org. But we're now working with the Library of Congress, where all of these interviews and all of our transcripts and all the videos will be archived and deposited. And they do also plan to have that publicly available on their website. We also, some of the interviews have been seen on commercial TV.
Mm-hmm.
I think various websites have small vignettes of that as well. So we tried to make this available because from where we're coming from, we want the 9/11 responder story to be told.
Will some of this be incorporated into the 9/11 museum when that opens in about a year?
We've been having some discussion with them, and hopefully it will.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about this volume, finally, We're Not Leaving, and what you've included in here.
Well, we've included over 30 interviews of responders. These are the way that we've done both our documentary as well as our book is that we've tried to keep the role of the narrator to a minimum. My voice is not heard it shouldn't be heard at all. Instead, we try to keep it to the actual responder stories in a non-interpretive type of manner, and so that when one reads the volume, they look at it from the point of view of going through those themes of the initial response and what was the motives and that took them through that response, the courage and the camaraderie and the collegiality that took them there to allow them to respond, as I said before, the sacrifices that they made, and then finally where they got their sense of renewal. But it's told only totally in the voice of the responder, so I think it's unique in that way.
Dr. Benjamin Luft, the book is We're Not Leaving, 9/11 Responders Tell Their Stories of Courage, Sacrifice, and Renewal. Dr. Luft, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff.